members of the Commonwealth Club of California, next Thursday, not Friday, but Thursday, we will have the third annual Pacific Festival Luncheon in the Rose Room of this hotel. There has been a change of plans as to the speaker for that occasion. Instead of having the Lieutenant Governor of Hawaii, we will have the Governor of Hawaii, Honorable William F. Quinn. Those of you who have heard Governor Quinn know that he is a forceful and colorful speaker who will do justice to this occasion. He will speak on the topic, Look West, America. Now, in addition to an outstanding speaker, we will have other special features for that occasion. It will be a ladies' day. And it says here we will have a Hawaiian orchestra and singers, a famous marimba band, paraded colors of all nations by the Boy Scouts of America, and last but not least, glamorous Pacific princesses from the Pacific nations. It will be a ticket luncheon. You will need to get tickets in advance, and the tickets are going fast. So now, if you don't bring your wife to this most unusual affair, and if she finds out later what a party it was, we will not be responsible for the consequences. There will be no luncheon on Friday, 1 week from today, which is a holiday. Our speaker today is a former San Franciscan who had the misfortune to be sent somewhere else. From 1940 to 1943, he was engaged in radio broadcasting work in San Francisco. Thereafter, for some 9 years, he served in the Army and in the Foreign Service, principally in public information posts in England, Luxembourg, Germany, Greece, and Switzerland. He is presently the assistant to the director of Radio Free Europe, which is a non-governmental agency devoted to principally to broadcasting to the satellite countries of Eastern Europe. Our speaker is on the firing line of the battle of ideas, the battle for men's minds between the free world and the communist world. It's a great pleasure to present Mr. Stuart L. Hannon, who will speak on the subject, the new Soviet offensive. Mr. Hannon.
Thank you very much, Mr. Meyer. It's a great pleasure to be here in San Francisco again, as you can well imagine. I see several former friends and familiar faces here, including, I believe, one of my former bosses, Phil Lasky. I don't know how many of you have seen this dashboard up here. It looks like the panel of a bomber. There are lights and gears of all kinds, and I see that I can lower myself in humiliation, or I can raise myself. I can do almost... We have nothing comparable like this in New York. We only have longer lunch hours.
Talk louder, please.
A little louder? All right. As I contemplate the subject that I had the temerity to accept as negotiable in 27 minutes flat, and as I see spread out here quite an assembly of men who probably know better than I that this is impossible, I think of the German private who was taken prisoner by the Allies as the war drew to a close. He was a provincial chap who had gone straight from a village into the Wehrmacht, very young, quite well brainwashed by Nazi leadership. And after routine interrogation, he saw on the wall a large map, a map of Europe. He saw Germany, he saw France and other familiar places, and then he noticed an enormous expanse of green which stretched to the east, clear off the map. And he asked what that signified, and he was told by the Allies, well, that's Russia. And suddenly a look of very dark alarm spread across his features, and he asked in a rather hushed voice, "But did the Führer know this?" Well, unfortunately, I can claim no such innocence, because I knew the dimensions of my talk when I agreed to it. I don't want to speak to you today like a statistician or a blithely impartial historian, because I can only speak to you as one who has been immersed in this Soviet communist business through diplomacy and propaganda in several countries for a long time. Therefore, I cannot isolate the challenge from our reaction, or can I speak like a disinterested observer. So it's on these terms that I hope you will permit digressions and even a certain partiality for our cause. Last July, speaking before one of those familiar assemblies of obedient vassals in Moscow, the present dictator of the Empire State, which has annexed or occupied 10 sovereign nations since World War II and split an 11th down the middle and repeatedly threatened every free nation in Europe with annihilation, launched still another threat to unleash Soviet missiles at the United States if we should interfere in any way with a Western Hemisphere dictatorship only 90 miles from our shore. Thus, the aggressive Communist Manifesto and defensive Monroe Doctrine of the 19th century have been brought face to face in the mid-20th. But I think the most remarkable sentence of the Soviet dictator's ukase was the concluding one. "This is a warning," he said, "to those who would like to solve international problems by force and not by reason." I think we need only take this statement, or any random catalog of such statements made recently by this dictator, and review it against the background of the past 5, 15, or 40 years, to realize that what is often called a new Soviet offensive is not new at all. Yet there is a little confusion about this. Prime Minister Macmillan expressed it in a rather vague spirit of consternation in his dispatch to Khrushchev after the Paris collapse, when he remarked, "I simply do not understand what is your purpose today." In Washington, simultaneously, Secretary Herter, when asked at a news conference about the motivation for the torrent of abuse from the Soviet, replied that one can only speculate on this, and speculation is difficult because of secrecy. I wonder sometimes if perhaps there's something eccentric or decadent about our system, our people, or civilization. After being threatened, kidnapped, beaten, and brainwashed, shot from the skies repeatedly, stopped even on the high seas, and denigrated before the world with shocking lies and insults, year after year, that we are prompted to comment after each new onslaught, "This is most strange," or "Isn't this unprecedented?" or "What does it all mean?" Now, I make this harsh inquiry not merely for the sake of effect, but to help remind us of two relevant factors. First, Western state policy and international exchanges still trying to adhere to a system which we once proudly called diplomacy, and confronted by some degree of unpredictable lunacy in Soviet communist methodology, believes that it must proceed on certain levels of comity and vagueness. But none of these formal postures should mislead or confuse public opinion. There are two forms of policy, stated and unstated policy, and we should all know this. And this is one of the reasons also, I hope, why we have a two-party system, why we have a Bill of Rights, educational institutions of all kinds, and civic bodies such as this, which meet regularly to main checks and balances, to study and interpret our system and other systems, and to keep in orbit these 50 stars of a constellation which certainly is as bright as history has ever seen. The second point I wish to make in this connection is that we, the whole people, have a citizen responsibility which we have failed to fulfill, and that is the responsibility to set aside time and effort aside from making money, from escapism of all forms, and from a totally unfounded complacency to cut through the duplicity of Soviet imperialism and international communism, to study this insidious and utterly ruthless alliance which is committed to our destruction, and at the same time to make our press and government more responsible in treating this crisis. If I may borrow the phrase of a certain candidate for public office, we need policies which are not limp with caution and conservatism. Now, I'd like to talk a few minutes about recent Soviet policy, which is essentially new only in context of the calendar, and then get down to a few geographical particulars and topical specifics: peaceful coexistence, cultural exchange, relaxation of tensions, which Soviet propaganda has draped rather grotesquely over the emotional hopes of millions. The essence of Soviet communism is power, and its aim is the destruction of the so-called bourgeois state apparatus. This we know, if we know fundamentals at all. But power is in certain forms deceptive, You are all familiar with Lord Acton's famous power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. In this sense, however, we think normally of physical power and its abuse. Armies, guided missiles, hydrogen bombs, imprisonment, torture, etc. Today, however, and in the immediate years ahead, I would stress even more psychological power and the abuse of the human mind. This may well be the decisive factor, as aggressive and deterrent terror cancel one another out, and especially as the enemy, and I'm not speaking here as a diplomat, as the enemy intensifies his propaganda, insisting that nuclear war is unspeakable, incredible, and almost impossible. We must be grimly realistic and wise at the same time in this deadly propaganda game of words, one of the most exemplary of which is communist peace, by which force moral confusion, relaxation, and weakness is intended, and its policy accomplice is Soviet secrecy, to force armament and accommodate the charge of warmongering. A few years ago, I spoke at Stanford University on the subject of the Soviet Union and foreign policy, and in that address, I said the following. We should face the fact that we are in a suspended war status with the Soviet Union. It was therefore of special interest, if somewhat chilling, for me to hear Congressman Judd of Minnesota remark just after the Chicago Convention that Nasser of Egypt had said to him in 1955, "The trouble with America is you simply don't realize that you're in World War III. You have been ever since the end of World War II. Now, I don't mean to dwell on this angle except to insist that war, like power, has several forms. Our job today, I think, is to prevent, if possible, the worst form, total war, from triumphing. We will not prevent it by compromising or surrendering one more fragment of democracy, freedom, or faith, but by reasserting them to their fullest capacity everywhere. There's nothing new in the basic realities of Soviet communism. Fluctuations of temperature do not change the nature of a disease until the disease destroys the patient or the patient conquers the disease. The familiar Jekyll Hyde pattern of Soviet international relations should be recognizable by now to anyone capable of recollection and simple cognition. But this doesn't mean that the Soviet power plays or feints are unrelated to the changing conditions or pressures both inside and outside of the communist world. There are changes, some of which the Russians don't like, and assail publicly as tensions. Personally, I can think of very few such tensions as they're identified by the Soviets, which we should ever dream of relaxing, unless we wish to accommodate the adversary's tactics and step up his timetable. As for the present spasm of Soviet tactics, its beginning is frequently mentioned as May 17th, when Khrushchev blew up the summit conference in Paris. But one could, with equal justification, establish the date early in 1956 at the 20th Soviet Congress, when Khrushchev disclosed unmistakably by words and actions that he was firmly in the saddle, even though he pretended for a moment that he would not ride it quite as ruthlessly as Stalin. Or the current intensification of Soviet attack and perfidy could date from the speeches at Baku or at Bucharest, especially the latter, which has been so hopefully interpreted as an irreparable schism between Red China and Russia. The American Bar Association said just the other day, very tersely, communist aggression started with the establishment of the Soviet Union, and that's good enough for me. But I don't think it really matters. Actually, the whole thing began many years ago and under many conditions, which converged nearly always in violence, distilling the worst of political judgment, economic experience, and what might be called national psychologies, not only of Russia, but of Germany. Vladimir Solovyev, one of those rare Russian moralists who can understand historic truth and intellectual honesty, wrote back in 1948, "The Reformation of Peter the Great introduced Russia to the workshop of Europe in order to teach her how to handle all the tools of civilization, but it ignored those higher principles and ideals which guided the use of those tools. Thus, though that Reformation gave us the means of asserting ourselves, it did not reveal the ultimate aim of our existence as a nation." If Solovyev were alive today, I think he'd be forced to say that the aim has been found by a successful conspiracy of successful men and twisted minds who have made notorious use of both simple and ambitious men. As history has proved repeatedly, victims choose their oppressors of the future. It was a curious alliance that saved Lenin, the Western parliamentary system, and the German general staff. In 1922, you may recall from history, Lloyd George wrote, "The Soviets have come to stay, and whether we like it or not, and one or another of these formidable men who rule Russia are likely to rule it for a long time to come." I think he was only wrong in thinking in terms of functionaries, most of whom were executed by their colleagues or successors, because the real rulers are Marx and Lenin. Perhaps even at this late date, it is worth recalling the remark of Lenin, "If the capitalist world had an ounce of solidarity, we could not survive for 24 hours." And half a century earlier, Karl Marx noted in one of his articles to the New York Daily Tribune, Marx was even one of our foreign correspondents, "The successful Russian diplomacy, that successful Russian diplomacy rested on the timidity of Western statesmen." Let's keep uppermost in mind the fact that we have been coexisting with the Soviet Union for a long time. All of today's captive nations tried coexistence with the Russian system, and few men tried more hopefully than Benesch or Jan Masaryk. Yet the hoax of coexistence continues to delude a surprising number of people who represent high position and enlightened society, men who even know that coexistence means the status quo of suppressed and partitioned millions of human beings, who know that it is only a device, even by communist definition and admission, of seduction and corruption. Who can describe this better than the top communist who went to prison for his apostasy in Yugoslavia, Milovan Žilas, who wrote, "In communist systems, corruption is an integral part of state policy, an enemy to thought in the name of science, an enemy to freedom in the name of democracy. The communist oligarchy cannot but accomplish complete corruption of the mind, and even, we might add, in free societies." The Russians are trained and callous masters of diplomatic dissembling, political and economic sabotage, of employing both ends against any center and vice versa. Their membership in the United Nations is perhaps the masterpiece of 20th century irony, and I might add, the most agonizing proof of Christian penitence. The Soviets operate within and without, for and against the UN at the same time. Verbal and material support for United Nations forces in the Congo, and Soviet trucks, aircraft, and Czech military mercenaries for Lumumba's invasion of Kasai and Katanga provinces. The Soviets have treated the United Nations resolutions on Hungary with total contempt. Soviet representatives were recently prominent in the UNESCO conference in Paris, which drew up a draft convention against discrimination in education, and the Russians were the most articulate in demanding that. At the same time, in the Political Map of the World, published in Moscow in 1958, is this peace-promoting and tension-relaxing assertion. In 1956, England, France, Israel, and the United States unloosed a military adventure against Egypt. Is it not bad enough to be confronted by such a system in so-called diplomatic meetings, to parley with them as one would with tribal chieftains, without opening all the avenues of this nation for their top agents, even to sponsor commercially their entry into the homes of millions by way of radio and TV? How many unsuspecting recruits have been won to subsidiary support of Russian positions through such insensate cooperation? Among these cultural ambassadors, ergo agents, came recently the Stalin Prize poet, Stepan Shipachev, who received his reward for a poem called Pavlik Marashov. If you can get it, I'd suggest you read it. Who was Pavlik? He was a young Russian boy who in 1932 denounced his parents to the secret police for hiding a little grain. The parents were executed, and Pavlik got a statue. And finally, a poem by this propagandist recently welcomed to America. Dedicated to the politics of subversion and extermination, and goaded by a sophistry of hatred, perhaps the Soviet's most flagrant perversion of its peace and relaxation hoax came recently with the brutal warning to Japan, just prior to the president's scheduled arrival there, concerning the defense treaty, which was signed nevertheless. But never was an act of government more clearly intended to urge violence against the person and office of a chief of state. It is a technique, of course, which the communists have used successfully in the Middle East and elsewhere. Now, one may interpret Khrushchev's mounting campaign since the U-2 incident to many factors. First, a made-to-order case for the Russian mind, espionage, which spells obsession to any professional conspirator, pressures at home in the Eastern European orbit, frustration in Western Europe, where he is now, at long last, rather stalemated as a result of his own behavior, competition with Red China, not only in the ideological field, but in the more worrisome geographical and demographic areas. And finally, there's the intriguing factor of foreign domestic trouble, which always spells opportunity for the Soviets in Asia, Africa, Cuba, and elsewhere. The communist cabal, and Khrushchev above all, could not, for example, in my opinion, have succeeded in exploiting Japanese unrest to the extent of sabotaging President Eisenhower's visit, had the Paris conference gone off according to hopes, and had the president's Soviet tour remained on the calendar. Now, with regard to the Paris fiasco and the U-2 flight, together they disclosed more political immaturity and emotionalism in our nation than even the enemy, I'm sure, expected to find. I couldn't begin to outline the national catharsis, and it is certainly not my purpose to review the handling of the affair. But there are footnotes for our topic. First of all, the assumption that Khrushchev was approaching his, and it was his, long-planned and staged offensive summit with any remote thought of negotiating in the Western sense, let alone conceding anything, I find rather puerile. Following his press performance, the key expression in our country was to salvage something from the wreckage. It's my contention that nothing can be salvaged from nothing, that the Paris summit offered even less than the Geneva summit of 1955, that it was only another calculated extension of Soviet foreign policy, which, fortunately for us, was not shaping up according to Khrushchev's expectations and the many careful plans which began with his visit and Mikoyan's to America. Allied unity, as the summit drew near, promised precious little. You may well be thinking, why did he go to Paris at all to do what he could have accomplished by sulking at home? He went, in my opinion, because of what appeared to be a rare opportunity to smash U.S. prestige in the most dramatic way imaginable by humiliating this nation's president to his face. And perhaps equally important, by declaring the president unfit to visit the Soviet Union. An exposure was avoided which might have shed light where shadows serve communism much better. Many years ago, Britain's Lord Curzon observed that Russian diplomacy consists of carefully laid, studied affronts. Not much has changed. It has been a constant of Soviet foreign policy to undermine the prestige and moral authority which Western civilization, and especially U.S. leadership, has achieved. In this context, I remind you that although the archenemy of universal peace speaks constantly of peace, he never speaks of freedom, because he cannot speak of what his system does not possess and does not want. Peace is a word which gives its enemies tricky opportunities. Freedom gives them very little but trouble. Those ingenuous minds which blame the collapse of Khrushchev's summit on the U-2 overlook many clouds on the Russian horizon at that time, and I'll mention only a few. The NATO conference at Ankara, which closed the ranks that the Soviet Union had tried to break. The House vote, 275-0, expressing its hope that President Eisenhower would seek from Khrushchev a restoration of the fundamental freedoms of all captive nations. 3, the almost hydrophobic reaction of Khrushchev to the earlier Captive Nations Week in Congress. 4, the foreknowledge of the fact that the Big Three had closed ranks, leaving the visitor little or no prospect of propaganda victory at Paris. 5, the prodding that Khrushchev had received from Suslov and the hardline faction in the Soviet Union and China. The U-2 was the windfall. Whether flame-out or low-level shot, whatever you want to call it, it took Khrushchev off the hook. With regard to the intelligence activities of any national security, whether on land, sea, or in the woodwork, response to the Soviet Union on this score, in my opinion, need not be apologetic or even civil. Perhaps the only realistic view of the whole affair came from Prime Minister Menzies of Australia, who drew interesting conclusions in terms of the surprising Soviet vulnerabilities. This leads me for a moment to Soviet propaganda offensive on the subject of disarmament. In his speech at Baku last April, Khrushchev repeated his line on disarmament as follows. Disarmament is the basic issue which has to be solved if the danger of a new war is to be removed. Typical of all aggressors and dictators, he speaks always of universally human desires in terms of threat or terror, danger, war, annihilation, total communism. The point of disarmament, however, although it is an ultimate solution, is that it is not the basic issue to resolve. It is not a first or conditioning premise. It cannot come first any more than law can be scrapped as the best or automatic method of abolishing crime. There is no time or need to go over the juridical and related issues of controls versus total disarmament. My concern within the context of this paper is with Soviet propaganda and what I call probity of intent. The basic issue of our time is not disarmament, but the abandonment of all tactics which make armament inevitable for the defense of nations as for the protection of human rights. The abandonment of Leninist policy against the non-Soviet world by deeds as well as by words, the removal of secrecy, of aggression against small nations and threats against all nations which happen to disagree with or reject predatory Russian policy. In a strictly logical sense, the question of disarmament is not even relevant. There is no inherent evil or dynamism in an aircraft carrier. The inherent evil is in the minds and will of men. The vast armament sent to Lebanon was silent and served not war but peace. The thousands of tanks and robots sent to Hungary waged war and served no peace but eternal peace. When those who campaign against weaponry are the same who employ weapons lawlessly, who have written a history of contempt for law, who refer to education as a weapon, and to writers as gunners, as Mr. Khrushchev did recently, there must be in consequence a certain distrust and insistence upon security. Let us not forget that weapons of war have been scrapped and outlawed repeatedly, but with certain men or party systems acceding to power, this has meant very little. The criminal or the cause of crime is not the gun, but the mentality of those who turn to it or encourage the conditions of its use. Two pivotal points of the Soviet blueprint for dismantling free enterprise and political democracy are Germany and Asia. Germany, because of its production energy and national psychology, both decisive factors in the East-West balance of power, and Asia for its restless millions and enormous sea frontier. Lenin's strategy of conquering the West through Asia is one of the many references in Soviet planning related to the ultimate direction of national policy. The Soviet Union has certain psychological advantages, admittedly, which still obtain, despite Hungary, despite Tibet, and other aggressive examples of basic intent, due to the long history and wide geographical pattern of Western colonialism. Momentarily, perhaps the Congo development has proved the point most alarmingly. Against this background, we must be alert and respond to the number of totally indoctrinated as well as technically competent Soviet technicians operating in Asia, the Middle East, and Africa, and their use in skillful propaganda. Undersecretary Dillon has repeatedly emphasized this area of danger and noted that Russian propagandists, whatever their official titles, have increased in number up to 65% in one single year. This situation is as much a toxin for private industry, it seems to me, as for government. Now as for the hue and hopeful cry over the Russian-Red-Chinese disagreement on ideology, which was heated up by the Bucharest speech. Russian technicians are leaving China, true enough. Chinese students are leaving Russia. Chinese ideologists will visit Eastern Europe to plead their case. These may be strains, but both Russia and China share basically the same communist ideology, especially the avowed hostility to the so-called capitalist world. Any serious split between these countries will be far more on a geopolitical basis than for any other reason. We must beware, however, of any fundamental compromise of our position with either in either case. The recurring communist argument that war is not inevitable between their system and capitalism does not mean what it says, exactly. Throughout Communist Party speeches and literature, the entire argument of non-war or non-violence depends, and this is a quotation, on the resistance of the exploiters, as they express it. This is an omnipresent refrain or qualification called both Soviet legality and Soviet reality. Their philosophy of just and unjust wars means nothing when it is understood as gospel by communists that any military action by them can only be just and military action by the enemy unjust. The logic is, in many respects, the logic of children. And in fact, much of Soviet communist propaganda takes into profitable account the fact that millions of people, even in Western or free societies, never grow up. Nazi propagandists were not the only ones who knew how to deal with child psychology in an adult society. Perhaps the Soviet communist return to their more normal posture of threat and denunciation makes much comment on coexistence at this point superfluous. It's simply the continuation of war by other means, and like everything else in the dialectical repertoire, peace, brotherhood, love of the worker, classless society, it is the opposite of what it professes to be. We would be ill-advised, I think, to assume that any of these contacts will weaken the central system or bring about what we would call the corrective processes of consensus. Internally, the Soviet Union is now a stable society. The present full Communist Party membership, according to the latest figures, is well over 8 million, an increase of 1 million since the 20th Congress. As a disciplined, dedicated, competent elite, we have nothing comparable. And as in politics, as in sports, I think, good professionals are usually better than good amateurs. Significant is the fact, perhaps, that the greatest Communist Party increase since the Hungarian Revolution has been in the Ukraine and in Belarusia. The average age of these people is 30 to 40. It's natural that youth should be contained, preserved, and rewarded. And beneath the CP of the Soviet Union is the Komsomol, the League of Youth, whose heavy recruitment campaigns have brought the total to more than 20 million, which is an increase of about 30% since the end of World War II. I hope I'm right in saying that there seems to be a new birth of hope in our country and in the West, that democracy may be on its feet again. Both national conventions raised foreign policy as the major issue, which is what it is. Both of them spoke frequently of freedom and very little of peace as submission, accommodation, or as something preferable to freedom. The awakening of India and Indonesia to the full cynicism and savagery of communism is encouraging. The new unity, statesmanship, and foresight of Western Europe is heartening. And even in the captive nations, precariously as they must live, there never ceases to be evidence of firm belief in political and religious freedom. Most significant was the recent warning of Stefan Cardinal Wyszyński to Polish communists to keep their hands off the church. "We are free citizens," he said, "of a country in whose defense even priests have been known to take up arms." His words were cheered by 50,000 Polish pilgrims who attended a religious festival despite communist opposition. Only by harnessing all of our energies and advantages and driving them into Soviet communist tensions and disadvantages will we begin to gain the upper hand. The Soviet Union has overextended frontiers, embracing well over 100 million non-Russians, not satisfied with the alternative of machine guns and carrots. Russia's masses of 200 million rub against Red China's 600 million, who reproduce, incidentally, at the rate of 20 million a year, as against Russia's 3.5 million. There are food and manpower shortages and other domestic conflicts which grind against the violent efforts to lift a backward agrarian country into the middle of the 20th century and simultaneously threaten the rest of the world. Committed to this propaganda of peace, heading an aggressive state geared for war, and attempting to maintain control over an international conspiracy dedicated to the eradication of democratic order, this is quite an order for Khrushchev. We shouldn't help him with it. Up to now, he has had success, and in no small measure because of the free world, with its hope, faith, and charity, easing his dilemma, bailing him out, affording him time, credit, trust, prestige. I think we should hope that this era of fantastic politics is ending, and that those among us who have come to think that defense is aggression, or non-compromise is warmongering, will have the courage to choose openly the system they prefer. The great battle for men's minds is not going to be won by little minds or ethereal dreams, by minds which, far from being brainwashed, require only a little rinsing. Whether the communist or any other threat to American democracy takes a fundamentalist or compromise view on the procedure of wrecking our system, we will not be best equipped to compete until we get back to our own fundamentalist view of the origins and purpose of our democracy, which is freedom and not peace, freedom and not prosperity, freedom and not comfort. At the same time, I'm sick and tired personally of these quasi-intellectuals and national psychiatrists who fill the national magazines with assaults, so-called objectivity, on almost every phase of our society, giving the ugly impression that there is very little to salvage at all. Many of them, too many, state quite directly that the real enemy today is not the Soviet Union or communism, but our government, our defense weapons, our institutions, our acquisitions. There is a Marxist infection among our people today, make no mistake about it. Some of it goes back to the early 20s, to Thorsten Veblen, among others, whose writings anticipate to the letter certain trends today, above all the Soviet coexistence line of no choice between Bolshevism and war. Communist propagandist, Soviet or American, cannot improve very much on the man who called the United States a psychiatric clinic in which the only good people were draft dodgers, conscientious objectors, communists, and hobos. It's time to rid ourselves, I think, of such influences, past and present, in order to stop the schizophrenia and creeping obsessions which are stock in trade of communist method. There are far too many experimental breeding grounds, kennels, if you like, for Pavlovism in our national intellect. I'm gratified that the American Bar Association, in a long report from the Washington Convention just ended, has hit hard at many of these aspects of communism, which I have hammered upon, without much effect, I confess, in both Europe and America since 1949. You might get the report and read it. I see that my time is about up. I would only end by saying that the secret of victory is often inscrutable, but in its pursuit, the philosophy of retreat, I think, carves small place in history. Only the determination of attack, implacable, no quarter attack or initiative, will preserve democracy when it is challenged by communism or any other brand of political tyranny. if we can ever bring the national mind to this resolve and bend all energies to it, above all the energies of private enterprise, if we deny to the enemy henceforth the cheap success of the bully and force him at every turn to show his hand, we shall convert that hot breath of the bully into the cold sweat of the desperate gambler who can ill afford to lose or play the hand he does not have. Thank you very much.
Justice Frank Bray, the chairman of our luncheon program committee, will preside today during the question period.
Mr. Hannon, one of the great indoor sports of the members of the Commonwealth Club is asking questions. Now, we'll see what kind of a sport you are in answering them. Will you come up here, Mr. Hannon, please? The first question is, the former United Nations delegate from Lebanon recently stated that while Russia had both economic aid and political ideals to sell to the world, he had observed that the United States only had economic aid to offer to the uncommitted nations of the world. Please comment. And similar to that, that would lead into the next question, what are the specific objectives of Radio Free Europe? Do they include liberation of the satellite countries? How might this be accomplished?
Well, those are two large orders. I have all afternoon, but I know you gentlemen don't. The first question, I think, must come from Ambassador Malik, former Ambassador Malik, who participated, as I did, in the recent Asilomar conference down on the peninsula. And I think I know quite well from the past as well as from the present what he means. He feels that too much emphasis in the past has been placed upon economic solutions to international problems, whether Marshall Plan or Truman Doctrine or the present foreign aid program, other economic issues, rather than sufficient attention to basic ideals and the idea of comradeship and fraternity, which haunts millions of people all over the world who don't even have the slightest idea of the meaning of what we blithely refer to as economics or standard of living or even the plane of living. I remember also that he commented upon the title of our Asilomar conference, which was, I think, Peaceful Coexistence, Dilemma of the Future. And this is part of his frame of mind. He criticized that as being another example in which we follow the initiative of the adversary. We even choose his language in setting up our conferences. I think in the past, Mr. Malik has been quite right. I think things are changing at present, and we are recognizing there's much more to the solution of the threat that faces us than economic aid or trade and financial or mere political adjustment to the communist threat. With regard to Radio Free Europe, what are the specific objectives? Do they include liberation of the satellite countries? How might this be accomplished? Whether the writer knows it or not, that's a loaded question. The specific objectives of Radio Free Europe are several. One is to prevent the communist monopoly of ideas in Eastern Europe and the spiritual capitulation of those 80 million people to the Soviet Union. Another is to convey some idea, if we can, of Western solidarity and, if possible, the rebirth of integrity and inspiration in what we call a Western heritage. Another is to get across the idea that free enterprise has a real value for humanity that transcends socialist planning and communist etatism and offers much more to man and extracts much less from him. And we therefore counterbalance Soviet propaganda to manipulate minds in a political blackout. Another purpose is to serve as one of the instruments of national security, as a communications lighthouse, a constant alert along that frontier which divides the free from the disenfranchised, all the way from the Baltic Sea down to the Black Sea. RFE is, in a sense, a non-military defense instrument, and it serves the free world purpose of security and political equilibrium by keeping what I consider a great balance of power in that state of balance, the balance of power of 80 million people in Eastern Europe. With regard to liberation, No, we do not plot or plan for the liberation of the satellite countries. We never did plan for the liberation of satellite countries, but to bring to them, to keep them constantly aware of developments in the free world, to keep hope alive, to give them, by precept and example, some reason for continuing to hope that there will be an adjustment of grievances and eventually someday a return to national sovereignty for those countries.
There are several questions along this line. What will be Khrushchev's propaganda tactics and goals at the United Nations this month? That's easy.
If that's easy, I wish our chairman would answer it, because if I knew the answer to that, I think I would market it and earn quite a lot of money. I haven't the slightest idea what his main objectives will be, what any secret objectives might be, except the broad ones, to continue with the advantage that he thinks he enjoys, and to an extent he does, to hammer home the advantages that he has picked up around the world, and to further drive home a discussion of a summit conference on his terms, which may conceivably even be in the United States.
I notice that every time that I pinch hit for President Graybill in this position, the speaker is always a tall man. Do you believe that it is good for our country to have so much publicity as to the details of our military installations and their locations, and similar more or less secret matters?
Well, that's easy to answer. The answer is no. I think it's tragic. Even within the necessary freedoms of democracy, to expose ourselves as much as we do in the area of what I would call security, especially when it becomes a matter perhaps even of national survival. I recall in the years long before we were in the predicament we're in now, in Europe, when the army had to expose publicly in the press all of its plans for the future, tell the Germans what we were going to do, how we were going to behave better toward them, how we were going to do this and that. What I call the constant publicity of your secret plans, or exposing the laboratory of your policy to anyone. I think that certain things should remain secret or highly classified. I do not believe that top secret information related directly to the security of the United States government is public domain.
What do you suggest that the United States do that it is not doing in order to win the war for men's minds? Don't you think the breaking of the Paris Conference was a blessing for us?
Well, the question was answered. Yes. I think the Paris Conference was a blessing, but we've had so many of these blessings after which we've always said, now this should convince everyone. Maybe this is the last necessary blessing. I'm not sure. I hope we will not have to go to the extreme of waiting 1 minute before Pearl Harbor. I think it awakened many people in this country, as every succeeding development, whether Sputnik or what have you, has awakened a few people. What we can do beyond what we are doing is to bring about a far greater coordination between the instruments of diplomacy and propaganda, to bring about a far greater awareness among broad groups of American people under the guidance, if you please, of civic groups, groups such as this all over the country, universities, foreign affairs councils and groups, to discipline their minds and enlarge their sphere of knowledge as to just what this struggle at this particular moment is about.
What good is it to rouse the people of the captive countries against communists through Radio Free Europe, and then when the time comes, we refuse to assist them to regain freedom? Hungary is in case.
Well, that's a good question. Is Leslie Bain in the room? There's a book called The Reluctant Satellites, in which this argument is put forth. And, of course, as you remember, there was quite a hue and cry about this at the time and after the Hungarian Revolution. First of all, we did not arouse the Hungarians. any more than American foreign policy aroused the Hungarians, or the existence of the United States government as a free people incites or arouses anyone, particularly people who do not have freedom, and particularly people who want freedom. What we did, as we do now, was to keep the line of communications open between the captive nations and the free world, to acquaint them with what is going on. We even went so far, as a matter of fact, I remember 8 months before the Hungarian Revolution, fearing that there would be some kind of an explosion somewhere in Eastern Europe because of the previous East German affair, because of the Poznan riots and so forth, we bent over backwards to implore people to undertake no action of any kind, individual or group, to do nothing or to say nothing that would endanger their lives or the lives of others, or more important, the hopes of some kind of an eventual evolutionary development whereby they would get their freedom.
On behalf of the club, I want to thank you for this very interesting and informative discussion. We'll have one more question, and then the meeting will adjourn without announcement. The last question is, how much jamming of Radio Free Europe's broadcasts is there?
There is still considerable jamming of Radio Free Europe, but one country has dropped out of the jamming operation, in 1956, and that is Poland. We are no longer jammed inside Poland by jammers. The other four captive nations still jam us, mostly with Soviet equipment, and of course we're jammed also from the Soviet Union. The jamming is heavy, but our power is considerable. We have a radiated power, which takes us up to about 20 million watts, if that means anything to any of you. We broadcast up to 3,000 hours a week. We are an ever-present communication which cannot be kept out. We broadcast on many frequencies. We broadcast constantly. We sometimes use all of our transmitters on one frequency. Our listeners, who have followed us for years, know where they can get us even more quickly than jamming can be moved over to cancel out all of our frequencies. This does not mean that we are not effectively jammed from time to time on certain frequencies, and sometimes even jammed out completely.
This is Stuart Richardson Ward, and across the microphone from me sits Stuart L. Hannon, assistant to the director of Radio Free Europe, who spoke before the weekly general meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California here in the Sheraton Palace Hotel in San Francisco on the topic, The New Soviet Offensive. Mr. Hannon, you used the word new in your title, I notice, but in your opening remarks, did you suggest that there's something eccentric or decadent about a system in which, after people have been threatened, kidnapped, beaten, and brainwashed, shot from the skies repeatedly, stopped in the high seas and denigrated before the world with shocking lies and insults year after year, that we in the United States still say to each other and in our newspapers and radio and television, this is most strange, unprecedented, or what does it all mean? How do you explain that, Stuart Hannon?
Well, I think it's very difficult to explain without taking into consideration our long and rather remarkable history. After all, we have grown up, we have tried to practice and improve our democracy for more than 160 years, and we have, with our puritanic background, with our belief in giving the other fellow a chance, with believing that one man or one system is just as good as another, that if people will just sit down at a table, they can solve all their problems. There's nothing, I think, essentially dedicated to power for the sake of power or evil for the sake of evil in our system. And therefore, it's almost inconceivable for many Americans to think of a system, or to understand a system like the Soviet Communist conspiracy, and to realize what it is really after, what it is predicated upon, and the methods it employs in order to achieve its ends.
But Stuart,
we are always ready with wishfulness, hopefulness, no matter how many times we are clobbered, we believe that perhaps this time Mr. Khrushchev or Mr. Stalin or Mr. Mikoyan or someone else really means what he says, and after all, as was said about Mikoyan's trip here, the man seems to make sense. My point there is that who would expect the number two man of the Soviet
Soviet Union to travel across the ocean to visit a country marked for eventual Soviet and communist conquest who would come here to make nonsense. These are skillful, tough, cynical, callous, ruthless crusaders for their system.
But, Stuart, we find here in the United States so many people, I could lead you to hundreds of them, literally, who'll say, oh, well, communism is some in Russia, some in your Red China, of course, and there's some down perhaps in the waterfront here and there, but will ridicule and attack and sneer at any individual that suggests that possibly in their parent teachers association, in their lodge, in their blue plate luncheon club, or wherever it may be, that they actually would be rubbing elbows or talking with an honest actual member of the Communist Party. They ridicule it. How come that way? Are we brainwashed, or what's happened to us?
Well, I would go so far as to say that there has been a certain amount of brainwashing. You don't have to sit in a dark room or in a light room under 5,000 watts of lights day after day in order to be brainwashed. Soviet communism has with great help from the Western world, done some remarkable brainwashing. After all, as I have pointed out, and as I think all of us know, we have turned over our radio and TV facilities to visiting firemen from the Soviet Union. The only trouble is they bring the fire; they don't put it out. We've had cultural exchanges. We've had agricultural experts and so-called people. I wouldn't go so far as Congressman Judd, perhaps, as to say that all these people are agents. But I've met some pretty grim-looking students traveling around this country.
The Nazis did the same thing, didn't they? The Nazis sent over technicians to teach the use of tractors in Latin America and Africa.
One of the oldest techniques, which go way back to the Egyptian world, one of the oldest techniques of aggression, of political aggression, and eventual military conquest is cultural exchange.
That was what the Greeks were doing when that horse was left.
It comes in different terms. It may be exchanged in the term of a gift. Remember the famous phrase, beware of the Greeks, for their hands offer gifts. There are many forms of this. The idea is simply there are many ways to destroy your enemy besides attacking him front-on, the frontal assault, with weapons.
Stuart Hannan, there were many phrases used today that reminded me of the late Elbert Hubbard's expression, referring to certain words that he said, cast a purple shadow. And one of your phrases today, which I'm not going to forget, was that you said, we need policies which are not limp with caution and conservatism. What do you have in mind there?
Well, I think I mentioned that I was quoting a... that's not my phrase. I was quoting one of the candidates for office, for the presidential office. And I think what he meant, and certainly what I meant, was exactly what the phrase says. You cannot compete with a ruthless system like Soviet communism if your policies are conservative, compromising, retiring, taking into maximum considerations all of the problems of a democracy, as if we were living in normal times, as if we had a democracy which was not under siege by a system which would like to destroy it. You cannot come into conferences with petty dictators and arch criminals and pretend that there's a moral equation at work. These are mistakes that we make constantly. You can't parrot legitimate principles, things that we have come to accept as examples of law and order, if the other party, if the antagonist, dismisses them as archaic notions of a decadent civilization. And you know from everything he says that he is out to destroy that civilization.
You said, Mr. Hannan, that in a talk down at Stanford, that we are in a suspended war status with the Soviet Union and should face that fact. And then you quoted Nasser of Egypt on that same line, didn't you?
Yes, that's correct.
What did you mean
yes,
by that?
Yes, my point there was that I had felt long ago that we were in a state of war, which is called peace. It's like a 1984 terminology of George Orwell. We are in a state of war, and I remarked it because I had learned only the other day from an American congressman that Nasser of Egypt had said to him way back in 1955, the only trouble with you Americans is that you don't realize that you have been in World War III since the end of World War II.
We know that the psychologists, Stuart Hannan, and some of them at least, the Freudian school, tend to teach that the tensions are the trouble with us, and a lot of us believe that if we only get rid of tension, everything's going to be hotsy-totsy. Perhaps a little bit like saying because an automobile engine gets hot and vibrates and makes some noise that therefore we should stop the engine and all would be well, because we have a doctrine, I believe now, of many psychologists that tension is necessary and essential to drive us on to achievement and work. Now, this tension in the world... we are taught universally almost that what we should avoid is any tension. Can we do that and still work in our own interests in all cases?
No, I don't see how we can avoid tension, and I think the last thing in the world we should do is to try to accommodate the Soviet Union or communism in relaxing what they describe as tensions. There are exceptions, of course, but by and large, all of those things which they castigate as tensions or warmongering are things which actually are part of our defense pattern. Merely because Khrushchev or Polyansky or Mikoyan or Menshikov or these people who float around the country making speeches or are constantly on radio and TV in other countries, merely because they would like to stampede us to a peace or to universal disarmament or to the various word concepts they use in order to undercut the very stuff and security of democracy is no reason for doing it.
I think so.
And we can only understand these things if we can get to understand or take the time to understand communist dialectic. We must realize that they are speaking a slightly different language than we are.
Stuart, will you please...
And it's a basic job of education.
Will you please define that term dialectic, because you're an expert in the field, and a lot of us have a vague idea just how to define. We hear communist dialectic referred to all the time. What is it?
Well, it's difficult because volumes have been written on it, but dialectic is in essence, their interpretation of, let's say, of historical development, of philosophical terminology, which, for the most part, is quite opposite to our interpretation of words. The euphemistic expression for certain things, for instance, you hear the constant phrase, the People's Republic of Czechoslovakia, the People's Democratic Republic of Poland, etc. You hear about the Labour Unity Party of Poland. It has nothing to do with the Labour Unity Party of Poland. It's the Communist Party of Poland. They force us, through their own terminology, to use words, for instance, such as government, when actually the word we should be using would be regime or oligarchy or something. Words, nomenclature, are very important in fighting this battle.
To make a very rough and ready definition, it means that they use words to mean what they don't.
Words which they do not mean, yes.
Yeah.
It's the best example of this, I think, is that remarkable and terrifying book written many years ago by George Orwell. Peace is war, slavery is freedom, etc.
Well, now, tell me, with the constant condition that you and I were talking about a minute ago before we went on the air, Stuart, that our papers are constantly saying the United Nations is puzzled by Russian move. President is enraged by what Khrushchev said. State Department shocked or unprepared for this. We've been reading that year after year after year. And one of your lines was a quotation from Marx, I believe, in which he said that successful Russian diplomacy had long rested on the timidity of Western statesmen.
Yes, that's very true. I think it was true then, and I think it's true now. The Hungarian patriot Kossuth wrote a whole book on that subject and gave many excerpts from it in 1852 when he visited the United States to try to explain to the American people, as he tried to explain to the English people, what Russian diplomacy, or today Soviet diplomacy, is like, how it operates, how it is a subterranean operation, an underground, long before we ever heard of the term the Soviet system. These are the things that simply must be more clearly understood. And I think it's a job of the American press, not only the government, but the American press, organizations like civic clubs, foreign policy associations, foreign counselor groups, to explain this, to get in touch with the people in every area on a kind of Minuteman system, so that we know what we are doing, at least we can find out where we have been and know better where we're going.
I understand that all Russian diplomats are required to be more or less expert in playing chess, and certainly in the mental field they've shown agility there. We think we're clever if we play checkers. They can move three, four, five, six moves ahead of
us. Perhaps the analogy is good, the difference between the mind that can successfully play checkers and the one that can successfully play chess.
Now, in the communist system, you said that corruption is an integral part of state policy. Would you like to illustrate that, Stuart Hammond?
I was merely proving my point by referring to that statement, which came from a top communist dialectician who should know what he's talking about, Milovan Djilas, the Yugoslav, who went to jail for publishing his book on this particular subject, corruption of state policy.
Well, they tend to glorify over there things that we consider contemptible and below the status of gentlemen or even decent human beings, don't they?
Yes, I think one thing we have to realize is that you simply cannot conduct foreign policy or so-called allied policy magnanimously if your enemy or your antagonist proves repeatedly that he does not recognize magnanimity. You can't try to proceed according to certain rules or protocol if your adversary doesn't recognize those rules or if he uses them only as weapons, subversive or otherwise, to destroy the positions you're trying to establish. These are the problems, I think, the matter of ends and means, that it's so hard for not only average Americans, but even people who are supposed to be professionally competent to understand.
Now, in regards to that, the spy flight, question was asked, why did Khrushchev go to Paris if he intended to direct the conference anyhow? You gave an answer to that. Go ahead, tell us.
Well, I said that I felt that he had perhaps a greater opportunity to drive home the advantages he had already achieved or had built up over the U-2 flight, to go to Paris, and in the presence of a world forum, you might say, and with all of the attention focused on Paris and all of the wishes and hopes that went with it, to embarrass and denigrate the President of the United States. I think that was an opportunity which he felt he could not turn down. And he could not have done that by remaining in Moscow and merely saying, the United States has sent spies to Russia and therefore I cannot communicate with these people. He had to drive the knife in, and that is why he went to Paris to do it.
Mr. Kay has said that the primary world problem is disarmament. You disagree with that. And you think the primary problem is what?
I think the primary problem is reducing all of those, to use one of Mr. Khrushchev's words, tensions which make armament absolutely necessary for nations, small or large, to defend themselves, for nations everywhere to protect the dignity of the individual. Disarmament in itself means nothing. What does mean something are the conditions which lead to the problem of armament or disarmament, not disarmament. There is nothing evil inherently in a gun or in a weapon. As I pointed out, we had much armament at Lebanon, which stabilized a dreadful situation and brought peace. The Russians used armament in Hungary, which brought deaths to 25,000 Hungarians.
Thank you very much, Stuart Hannan, for this splendid and altogether too brief chance to share with you your thoughts and your profound knowledge and experience in this field. And now may I announce that next week, in the same program, same time, same station, we will be interviewing for you the Honorable William Quinn, Governor of Hawaii, on the topic, Look West, America. Thank you again, Stuart Hannan.